This is Detective David Love.
This is Dr. Lana Love.
Welcome to Universal Soul Love Radio.
Great to have you with us. And today we have a very special person, Mary Read, as our guest.
Mary's the author of The Unwitting Mystic.
Mary is a visionary speaker. Mary is what she calls an unwitting mystic who had 11 years of profound involuntary visions and insights into divine realms. Mary was originally an executive, but then changed her life remarkably and now lives in a nunnery in India where she spends a lot of time immersed in silence. She has written a wonderful book, and she joins us now. Mary, thank you for being in our show.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the show, Mary.
Hello, hello. It's very, very nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. We met you through Matthew Hart, who was on our show a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I'm delighted to be here. I'm actually in the home of John Smallman. I don't know if you all know who John is, but John is a guy who has a wonderful blog, John Smallman's blog. He channels Jesus. And so he's hosting me on my tour up here in New Hampshire. So I'm in his home right this minute.
Oh, you're in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm from Boston originally, so I'm familiar with New Hampshire.
Yeah, and it's peak color season, so it's a really beautiful time to be up here.
Oh, autumn is beautiful in New England.
Mm-hmm.
I miss it.
Mary, it sounds like you had a very, very amazing turnaround in your life, from being an executive in America to living in a nunnery in India. How did it all happen?
Sounds like a spiritual awakening.
Yeah, in the ultimate sense, certainly. Well, you know, it was I wouldn't have known what an awakening was when all of this began. I was not familiar or interested in any kind of religious pursuits at all. I was never a seeker. I never had a lot of questions. I've never read the Bible. I wasn't one who went around sort of seeking answers to life. I just wanted to be kind and compassionate. And to be honest, when I was growing up, I wanted to be an opera singer or backup dancer for Michael Jackson. I never had any kind of interest in religion or spirituality at all. So this kind of, when things started happening with me back in, actually 16 years ago this summer, back in 2000, it was a really big shock for me. And it started with me hearing a voice telling me that I was supposed to be doing something very important. And at the time I was living in Washington, D.C. I was directing clinical research programs in respiratory medicine. So I already thought I was doing something very important. And I tried to ignore the voice, but over the course of 6 months, that voice just kept getting more persistent and more pronounced, and it ended up with me seeking hypnotherapy to dig a little deeper and see what was happening. And in that hypnotherapy session, the very first thing that happened was that I went into the body of Jesus at his moment of death on the cross, and had this magnificent view of the world, everything over the history of mankind over untold millennia, and could see exactly what led to that moment, the mindset that led to that moment, not just the things that happened sort of at the crucifixion scene or in the years leading up to that, but literally over centuries previous to that. And so it was that session that was 3 hours that sort of led me into starting having these visions and insights spontaneously. And that sort of set my world in a completely different path because, you know, once you have these visions into divine realms, your regular world looks very different, and especially when you live in Washington, D.C., and you have kind of a different backdrop to life. So that's what started it 16 years ago, and I had 11 years of really a lot of confusion trying to hold these visions and insights that then started happening spontaneously, and trying to live my normal life in here and directing programs here and Europe and eventually working in Africa. And finally, my world just started tipping upside down when the normal parts of my world started to fall away, and the successes that I had always had a lot of abilities in just began to crash. You know, my money, my finance, my home, my relationship, my work, everything. And wow. The only thing left was sort of this spiritual peace. And for me, my big turnaround was ultimately a suicide attempt in March of 2011. And I had this miraculous survival of that event. And at that moment, it was realizing, you know, I'm really not the one in charge here. There's something else happening. There's something else going on. And after that event, then I was suddenly led into all of these doors that just started opening, leading me into understanding what to do with my spiritual work. And that landed me in a Buddhist nunnery at the foothills of the Himalayan mountains back in October 2011. Literally, I think 5 years ago yesterday, in fact. And that's where I've been ever since. Just sort of letting everything sort of come to me, stopping my the normal expectations of what a life should be, and letting everything sort of unfold in the mystical sense. And I came out just 2 years ago as a mystic. Finally, I released my book and have been touring the last couple of years just sort of telling my story of what happened and how I see this awakening world from a mystical perspective. And then this year, finally, after 16 years, I ultimately now know what I'm talking about and know what to do and know what it's all sort of boiled down to. So that's how I got here today.
Wow, that's an amazing spiritual journey. I can definitely relate to that. I think our audience knows my story somewhat. Some of it, Lana certainly knows all of it, or most of it. It's pretty dramatic. Luckily for Lana, Lana's has a lot of knowledge without having to go through a lot of the trials and tribulations of having whatever that is, a spiritual awakening or a psychic awakening, because I've been through, I've had similar experiences, so I can definitely, like I said, relate to what you're saying. And
it certainly sounds like your world was completely
upside down.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Rudy Bauer, who's the director of the Washington Center for Consciousness Studies in Washington, D.C., I recently just, I think 2 weeks ago, gave a talk with him and a group of therapists, and we were talking about this idea that when Padmasambhava was a great Buddhist teacher, and he talks about when the light hits the darkness of the mind, that there is a fragmentation that happens into that sort of light infiltrating the darkness. And when that happens, the fragmentation portrays itself on the exterior as life falling apart. And ultimately, that's exactly the way that it happened for me. It doesn't happen that way for everybody, but it makes a lot of sense in terms of if that's what's happening internally, there will be that reflection on the external. And that's really, in a very dramatic sense, what happened with me, because I had been remarkably successful, helped a lot of people, traveled the world, made a lot of made a lot of good things happen. And then suddenly, there's nothing at all that I could do, not one thing. And it wasn't until I had this very supreme surrender of just stopping everything completely and letting the universe then take over that the real magnificence of life could then be revealed. And it truly has been magnificent ever since.
That is
That's amazing,
very inspiring. Mm. I guess what we're talking about is that the ego keeps fighting and the ego dies, and then you surrender to the rest of the universe and you, in fact, become the universe. I know that an acquaintance of mine experienced, I guess, what could be a near-death experience and possibly enlightenment. And he described, his name was Professor John Wren Lewis. He was a physics professor at Sydney University, and he was certainly not a religious or spiritual person. And he experienced a near-death in Thailand after a busload of tourists got poisoned and robbed. He woke up in this Thai jail, a Thai hospital, and everything had changed, and he had this amazing experience, like the back of his head was connected to the whole of the universe. And he said that where before it was John Wren Lewis experiencing the world, it became the world or the universe John Wren Lewising.
Yeah, I understand that, completely. I've totally had that exact same kind of experience. And in fact, in one of my experiences, I actually say out loud that I have this body because that's what people can understand. That's what people can concretize and make sense of. But the rest of sort of the universe behind me is experiencing it through me, and vice versa. And so, but on this side, in the visual, in this 3D reality, people get a very narrow, you know, view of it. But from the other side, they get the whole expanded view of it. That's gorgeous.
I tread between two worlds, and it's very odd because I'm here, but my greater consciousness, I'm sort of aware that I'm not only here in the physical realm, I'm also aware of another greater, a higher realm that I'm in as well. And it's my experience was so dramatic. I guess I'll quickly say what my experience was, because
yeah,
I know we're going to be talking about love in the second half, which I'm very excited about, pure love and truth, and very excited about that. So I just want to say
too.
That my experience with my awakening, or whatever you call it, and I call myself a mystic because I guess I have a Rosicrucian background, and it's just a title I give to my belief systems. And that's all it is. But and you could easily call yourself a druid or a teacher or anything else, whatever label you want to use. But in my experience, at the height of my so-called awakening, I was talking with Lana and some friends at dinner the other night about this. I actually was sitting in front of my computer, and Lana, you know, being a doctor, would understand this. I was disassociating, and suddenly I found myself sort of, my vision sort of became black and white, and all of a sudden I found myself somewhere else while I was sitting in front of my computer, and I found myself in a hospital bed with wires attached to my head, and it was like I was waking up out of anesthesia, and my eyes were sort of half open, and I could, the person that I had been talking to on chat, maybe it was Facebook chat, was still there. And he was saying, oh, to someone else, looking down at me with my eyes half open in this hospital bed, saying, oh, he thinks it's still me, and to the other doctor or whoever was there, these spirits or wherever I was. I don't know where I was. It was sort of a disassociated experience. And some woman walked by, and I guess vaguely I remember this. And it was a woman from another life, a past life partner, who was she was saying something to me, and the doctor was saying, don't worry about her. You'll probably never see her again. And then we went to group trauma therapy, where we would talk about our experiences in life and try to work through it. And it was almost a badge of honor for the people there that you experienced more trauma than the other person, because you actually learned more. And then the only other thing I remember was the person saying, don't feel bad that you're sleeping so much. You need your sleep. And I couldn't really see exactly where I was, and it was very much sort of grayish and black and white, and I don't remember a lot. But then I remember,
it sounds like you were sort of in between lives.
I had experienced a spiritual death, and then I met this the goddess, the divine feminine essence, or whatever, and I made an agreement to come back, and you know, to be in this life now. And my whole world got turned upside down, and I became a new person, and I actually have a collective or a cluster that supports me, because in my previous life, from what I understand, I was going to die anyhow. I could no longer survive because my personality wasn't suitable for surviving in this world, apparently. And so I'm now supported by my past lives, my collective, and by the divine feminine essence. And I also have a higher mind or a higher self. And it's very difficult for me to understand all of these things. But that's part of my experience.
That's beautiful. And, you know, I think that you've had the opportunity to sort of meet your team, right? Your soul group, or whatever you want to call it. And then your guides and guardians. And there's a whole network of support that we all have. And so it's a rare thing to be able to meet them. So that's gorgeous.
And I've met a lot of people in life that I've worked with in other lives, you know, my soul family or my soul tribe, people that I've identified and, you know, I remember certain experiences from past lives. So and I ended up in Australia of all places. I could have ended up anywhere in the world. So it was this dramatic my life was just dramatically, I feel like a new person in a new place, like Alice in Wonderland being taken to Oz.
And I guess, Mary, you found yourself in India. You found yourself in a completely new place as well.
Well, yeah, but you know, India was always very much low on my list of places to want to go. I've traveled the world. I had traveled the world a lot before then. I worked in Africa and Europe and other places. And India was always on my no thank you list because I always ironically thought it was too spiritually woo-woo for me. And I really had no interest whatsoever in it. And so when the way that I ended up there was that I was ultimately invited to meet the Karmapa. The Karmapa is the Buddhist leader. He's a teacher who is the man who is slated to take over as spiritual leader for Tibetan Buddhism when the Dalai Lama passes on. So he's second in line for the leader of Tibetan Buddhism. And I was invited there by someone in his contingent to tell him my events and whatever. And so they set up a room for me. I had a big meeting with him. And then he gave me the guidance to sort of stay and take the time to really understand who I am. And it was that guidance that ultimately led me to living in the nunnery at the foothills of the Himalayan mountains. And that's where I've been now for the better part of 5 years.
And so, Mary, have you also met your spiritual contingent, your guides?
Yeah, I did. That was the second big metaphysical event I ever had, which the first two events were back-to-back over the course of a weekend under hypnosis. And I talk about this in my book. Those are the events that sort of, you know, flung open the spiritual gates to my metaphysical abilities. And on the second day, I had this big meeting. I, of course, at the moment had no idea who they were, but a very large group of, I don't know what to call them, they're light beings, but I call them angels or my soul group or whatever, but very, very well known to me and have obviously been together with me for a long, long time. And they are definitely my guides on a different level. They're with me through this entire journey. It's a bunch of heavy hitters. I don't know exactly who they are. I know several of them are archangels, but I don't know who the rest of them are. But yeah, it's been a real joy. And, you know, David, I don't know if you had the same experience, but I wish that people would talk more about the exquisite playfulness and joyfulness of the divine beings in these divine realms in our soul groups, because my experience has been so consistently that these beings are just so magnificently playful and joyful, and there's an effusive purity of joy in their love that we don't really talk a lot about in our mystical experiences. And it is such the pleasurable part of these engagements, I find.
I only had, maybe I haven't had a lot of the same experience as you, but there was just one experience where, I mean, I went through a long, several months of experience with this goddess or divine feminine essence, this relationship that I had at that level. And finally, one night, I experienced this thing that I can only call divine love or higher love, where I saw this white angelic goddess being floating through my room at midnight. Mm. And I felt so much love that it's impossible to express what it felt like.
Yeah.
And it was just an overwhelming sense of divine love. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've ever felt anything like that.
I call these engorging experiences, because you feel fully engorged with whatever the sense of purity is that they're present with. So if it is love, this deep, unconditional, exquisite field, there is an engorging in your physical sense of all of it. And it is just so unlike anything that we sort of, you know, in our physical life, we experience everything through our physical senses. And that's a neurotransmitting interpretation of reality. And so there's a lot of dulling of our senses. Mm. But when you're engorged with this purity in a direct relationship with divine entities, divine beings, it's completely transcends all of the dulling effects, and you just get this deep purity that is so exquisite. It's just glorious.
It does sound wonderful. I can't wait to have mine. and Mary, it's good to know that not only are they full of love, but that they're playful and sounds like they really know how to party.
Actually, they are. That's true. I have seen them be very playful. I've seen objects dematerialize and rematerialize in other places in the past. I'm pretty sure. I mean, you know, I'm an investigator, so I'm an investigator, so it's difficult for me.
You have a filter, yeah.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I'm investigators are open to everything, but they're also skeptical. So
yeah,
it's,
sure, sure. Yeah, you have a nature for that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's very nice to know that angels have a sense of humor.
Yeah, they do.
I have had so much, and you know, when they have this sort of purity of playfulness and sort of poking at you in kind of a funny way, the level of that purity just makes you want to break down and cry because it's so pure. It's so deeply honest in how loving and playful it is. And we don't have, you know, it's like a puppy, right? The puppy has no filters and it's just pure. But they are just like on this, you know, sort of supreme level, and it's really quite piercing. Now, I have to say, I've not had that sort of playfulness too much with Jesus, but I've definitely had it with angels and Buddha. Buddha is very funny, and God, you know, sort of the ultimate source. So I've had it in a lot of moments where there's a lot of sort of proof of the levity of things in the big picture. You know, that everything is divine in its perfection, and that we can take great joy and pleasure in that as well as taking it so seriously.
I always thought one of the things I've thought is that life is hard, but it's not that serious, only because my first spiritual piece of knowledge was about death, was about transition, and that life is short, and so it's important to just live life to the fullest, because no one else is going to do that for you. It's important for us to take charge and live and have joy in our lives.
Yeah, so. I talk a lot about this to people on tour, and especially in the one-on-ones, when people have a lot of very serious questions, especially young people. You know, young people really have this desire to just get it, you know, to like get the whole picture and what this is all about. And I have to remind people that, you know, the point about this is figuring out that it is a joyous exploration of experience, that the joyous perspective is always a choice. It is just as much a choice as anything else. Any single point that we choose to focus on, we have an infinite number of choices that we can make about how to react with it or experience it or perceive it. And we are just conditioned out of the joyful perspective. But yet, it's certainly always one of the options available to us.
Mary, that's a very, very inspiring message. I'm going to be the devil's advocate here, if you don't mind. Here in the first world, obviously, we get stressed, but we have everything we want. And certainly the idea that it's our choice to have a joyous experience, I think it really holds. It makes a lot of sense. However, you're over in India. And look, I love India. I've been there myself as a tourist. However, there's so much poverty, there's so much disease in a third world country or in a war-torn district. How is it that people can still make a joyous choice?
Great question.
You know, when we see these experiences like poverty or war or right now in America, our political season, you know, there's a lot of things that feel quite insane, quite unjust. And it's very hard to sort of think how on earth could this ever be joyous? And there's a couple of things that we need to keep in mind. First of all, what we're seeing in these experiences is an outcome of something. It is not in and of itself the problem. It is the ideology and a momentum that is expressing, right? It is an outcome of something that began, a mindset that began long, long before what we see in these moments. So taking our taking our eyes off of the expression so much as looking back and what caused it long ago. So there's a little bit of a stepping back, but also remembering that it is not the experience itself, like the expression of somebody's anger or a school shooting or something like this, so much as it is the important thing for us is our response to this expression. It is not the expression itself. It is our response to this expression. And in our response, we have every opportunity to meet it with any kind of energy that we want. And is somebody typing? I can hear typing. Oh, sorry. I see your
No worries. No worries. Just giving him a note because we're going to be going to break.
I couldn't figure out what was coming into my headphones. Anyway, so first of all, there is the idea that we don't have to react directly to what's happening, but sort of take a step back and understand that it is our reaction to these events that is much more important than the event themselves. So we don't meet it. We don't have to meet it with the exact same kind of energy that we feel coming from it. So if it's a very explosive, negative, painful kind of thing, if we met it with the exact same kind of angry, pain-filled kind of reaction, then we just fuel that same kind of energy. So first of all is allowing it the space to just be what it is. And our response, the field into which it comes, does not have to be that same level of response. So first of all, there's this ability to step back into it. But the second thing is realizing that the base of these events, that these things that we label as negative or we label as painful are actually an expression of pain, a deep expression of pain. And so we can then begin to relate to what's happening in a much more compassionate way. And if our response to pain is one that is met with a genuine kind of nurturing response, there's always joy in an opportunity to be nurturing. It may not be something that's kind of a piercing, jovial kind of joy, but what a pleasure it is to respond in a nourishing and nurturing way to pain. And just innate in us, it is a joy to be able to meet something in a healing kind of way. And so we have a different kind of definition of what joy is or what reaction can be. And it is always a choice to react in a more nurturing and joyous, sort of innately kind of joyous way. Does that make sense?
Sure. You're talking about compassion and understanding, I think. You're talking about even with hostile people or service to others who are in pain and suffering. And I've worked with criminal offenders in the court system doing criminal defense investigation for many years, and I've worked in hospice. And I have to tell you, I find this incredibly difficult to do what you're saying, but I do recognize that understanding people leads to empathy and compassion. I think that's what you're saying.
And well, go ahead.
Yeah, what you're saying, Mary, is that we have the capacity to bring whatever energy we choose to any situation, that there is a difference between the situation that we may walk into and our response to it. Right. And I think that's an incredibly important point.
Yeah, well, so a couple of years ago, I was giving a talk in Greenwich, Connecticut, and I was talking about this idea that the expression of an outcome of some kind of ideology, that we must remember that it is not the expression that is the issue. It is our response to it that is the most important thing for us to think about. And in the audience that day, there were two women from the Sandy Hook community, which here in the United States, that was one of the communities that was part of a big school shooting a few years ago, actually a couple of years right before my talk. And so these two women from the Sandy Hook community, they raised their hand and said, actually, we can speak to that firsthand. Because the day of the shooting, I don't remember how many children were killed, but, you know, there was a lot of media that came in, a lot of social services that came in, et cetera. And they were well aware that everybody had a mindset of anger, of hatred, of blame, of victimhood, et cetera. And they wanted to lash out. They wanted to hate the shooter. They wanted to blame the mental health services and gun control and all of these sorts of things. But the immediate community realized immediately that what was needed in that situation was love, not hate. And these women said, we knew immediately the last thing that we needed was more hate, was more anger, was more blame, was more of this and that. And so they coalesced immediately in their core community around the motto, we choose love. They had T-shirts and bumper stickers and all these other things. And that's the response from which they spoke to the media and they spoke to other people. And so the healing could begin from a much more nourishing and nurturing kind of place. They said this young boy who was the shooter, he's had far too much hate in his life. The thing that he needs and we will give is love. And so from their perspective, it was very much a different kind of meeting of that ideology. And on a more global scale, a great example is this young woman, Malala, who is the 12-year-old girl. At the age of 12, she was shot in the head by the Taliban in Pakistan because she and her father were promoting education for girls. And Malala, when she was shot, she didn't go to the United Nations and say, you guys need to pick up tanks and fight the Taliban. What she said was, you need to pick up pencils and help us educate girls. And her tagline was, with guns you can kill terrorists, but with education you can kill terrorism. And so it was addressing more the ideology of these events, the ideology of the cause, the ideology of the momentum. And then when that expression happens, you don't meet it with the same ideology, but rather you turn it towards something that is based in more of a divine intention, a divine intention towards love and equality and freedom and these sorts of things. And so you shift that momentum on a very important collective scale. And you do that in, you know, sort of the grassroots level, in the events like Sandy Hook, or on a more global level in the case like Malala. And this is happening more and more and more and more in our world, that we're learning that our response can be anything, and we're learning to respond in a deconditioned, kind of more accepting, more sort of objective point of view. It's not everywhere, but it's certainly the momentum that is going now. We're creating a new momentum and a new ideology.
And that's fantastic, because I know we do have a lot of activists on our show, and Leonard and I do consider ourselves to be social activists, but we're talking about a different type of activism, a different method of operation in activism. And I think that's fantastic. Yeah, because I don't think you can't win a war, you can't win an argument or win your cause by fighting fire with fire, bullets with bullets, or dropping bombs to solve a problem. We've never solved any problems with swords or guns or bombs yet.
No, and this is what we're doing now in our world. We're creating a new kind of conditioned reaction, because we have historically, for centuries, been in a conditioned way of, you know, sort of back up and fighting fire with fire, as you say. And you know, for the last 100+ years, we've realized that there's definitely a different way. And so in lots of little, small, and large ways, we're seeing this deconditioning of one kind of reaction and a reconditioning of a whole new kind of reaction based in a more accepting, open, healing kind of base.
Excellent. Okay, I think we're going to take a short break.
Okay.
And then we want to come back, and I want to talk about more about love, pure
love.
Let's
do it.
Hello, this is Detective David Love.
Dr. Lada Love.
Welcome back to our show, Universal Soul Love Radio.
So we're talking with Mary Reed, who's the author of The Unwitting Mystic.
Welcome back to our show, Mary.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
And Mary, we wanted to also mention your website.
Yep. The website is unwittingmystic.com.
Okay, and where can we find your book?
You can find it on my website. Yep, you can find it on my website, or you can find it on Amazon.com in print or e-reader.
Fantastic.
All right. Remini, great conversation.
We wanted to talk more about love and maybe the practical.
Let's do it. We don't do this enough on universal soul love. We actually need to get into the heart of love.
Yeah, you know, this is why I'm actually talking about this on my tour this year. You know, everywhere we look, all the memes on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and, you know, people talk about it from the pulpit and, you know, lots threaded through lots of teachings. It's all about love. But nobody talks about what is love. And so I'm on tour this year. I have about 30 stops on my tour this year. And I'm answering this particular question. If love is really all you need, if love is the answer, then why hasn't love ever been able to make our suffering go away? Why hasn't that ever been enough? Yeah, I bet you do.
love conquers all. I hear it all the time. Love conquers all. Love, love, love. Love is all you need.
Yeah.
We've had avatars. We've had Buddha, Jesus talking about love. And yet we're still dropping bombs in Syria and many other places. Mm-hmm. So.
What an excellent question. So, Mary, what would be your answer to that?
Well, you know, the way that I give this answer on my tour is obviously going to be much more extended than the time we have for here. I actually use an actual metaphysical event to answer this question. And I've been having metaphysical events now for 16 years. And ultimately, in my metaphysical events, I always, about 90% of the time, I go into the origins of what we think of as divine truth or issues that are pertinent to the understanding of divine truth. So, for example, I just mentioned earlier going into the crucifixion scene, going into the origins of Christianity and experiencing the world in that context from the vantage point of Christ, and going into the mind of Buddha at his first moment of enlightenment. And so it's the foundations of Buddhism from the vantage point of Buddha. And so this is the nature of my insights. They're quite profound, and they're always related to the origins of things. And so this year, April 25th of this year, I had a metaphysical event in which I went into the origins of separation consciousness. And so viewing in this separation consciousness the origins of our building of our reality in a dualistic separation consciousness paradigm. And at the base of this is ultimately just an inherent form of self-rejection. And so, for example, all of the things that we label as negative, fear, judgment, poverty, war, violence, self-loathing, et cetera, on and on and on. The list is just endless. All of these things that we label as negative are actually just experiences of the pain of the separation from our knowledge and our awareness of ourselves as divine love. And so these are actually our cries for union with love. But what we do in a separation reality, in our dualistic reality, is that we actually use what we think is all of the goodness in us, kindness, compassion, caring, concern, empathy, etc., to reject these other parts of us. We have a model in our world of the good in us trying to make the bad in us go away. So we want our kindness and our compassion and our concern, et cetera, to make our fear and our judgment and everything else go away. But what we're actually rejecting in this model is our cry for union with our divine nature. And we know this because we all love the story of good trumps bad. We love it.
We do. We do, don't we?
We love when karma comes around to bite the bad guy.
Major motion pictures.
Totally. We love Disney, right? We love the Disney model. It's the same exact paradigm that is in all of the magnificent conflict arcs of our books and our movies.
That's right.
It's threaded through religious doctrine. It's the building blocks of our education and our economics and our governance and our cultural and societal systems. And when we realize that what we are ultimately doing in this paradigm, when we think we're applying love to heal the pain of separation, we're simply just employing paradigm of self-rejection. We want one part of us to make another part of us go away. But ultimately, what we're crying out for with all of these things that we consider negative that are born in the pain of separation consciousness, we're crying out for divine love. And divine love is something completely different. Divine love is not an action imposed on anything. Divine love is a state. It is a state of being. And it is a state of being, first and foremost, unconditional. That we impose no conditions on anything to exist at all. Everything is in its divine nature. It is, second of all, a state of equality, that everything is equal in its value and its potential and possibility to exist. Okay. It is also a state of pure freedom, that everything is free to express what it is as it is, with no oppression or suppression. It's the state of ultimate unity, that everything is brought into a state of unity and oneness with everything else, and it is the ultimate in state of acceptance of what is in this present moment. So what we cry out for, what love actually is a state of being in our own field, unconditional, equal, free, unified acceptance of what is within us. And this is the thing that meets everything that we reject and says, we no longer reject you. And we get into this place ultimately of unifying ourselves with our divine nature.
That's an amazing definition of love. So what you're saying is the idea, the dualistic thinking of good versus evil or dark versus light.
Yep.
I mean, obviously it's love is absolute. Love is unconditional, and love would also love the darkness, you're saying.
Entirely, but also love would have no label for that darkness. You see, so much of our problem comes in this label, because we give it a label inherently. The moment you give it a label, you give it a separation consciousness paradigm. So it is simply an experience that we can have of the divine. We don't have to call it anything, but the moment that we give it a label of dark or ego or any of these other things, we have categorized it into that negative, trying to overcome or make it go away or whatever, when in fact, it's from the same exact source as everything else is from our separation consciousness. And so it is about incorporating all of it as a basis of equality within each of us in a state of divine love entirely.
I understand.
Mary, I do understand the profound nature of what you're saying. I still, however, struggle with the idea of accepting the evil,
brutality,
the nasty
violence,
brutality,
oppression
in the world.
Sure. Well, if you know that all of that comes as an expression of deep, profound cry and painful cry for union with who we are, we begin to have a much more tender relationship with that expression. And remember, that expression is coming from a mindset or an ideology that is old, old, old in us. It is nothing that is new. And it is always something that we have rejected. And rejection is the very thing. Rejection is at the core of separation consciousness. It is the very thing that gives it life. So if we reject all of this feeling that we have, it doesn't mean we don't have it. It just means that we reject owning it. And so once we allow these things to be owned in the honesty of what they are, they lose entirely all of their power over us. And then we can incorporate them so perfectly and beautifully into the divine field of divine love. This is what we cry out for repeatedly.
So when you say that we reject owning it, are you talking about the fact that we need to accept that there is darkness within us as well?
Well, or we don't label it as anything, that darkness is simply an experience that
it's
feels
behavior.
Different. Yeah, it feels different than other things. Everything feels different, but we label it as something and then have all of these myriad associations with it that just keep it in kind of a repressed, oppressed, ignored, rejected kind of place. Yes. It's not going anywhere. As Pema Chodron so brilliantly says, nothing ever goes away until it teaches us what we need to know. Sure. And so we need to know that these things really are indeed a part of us. But if we look deeply and honestly and patiently and compassionately underneath every one of these, it is all just pain. And so our hope is to answer and that cry, that pain, in a state of acceptance to say, I see you. You're right. I absolutely see you. I see you in a very loving and compassionate and embracing kind of way. And then it has no power. It has no momentum anymore. We have shifted and transmuted that energy now to part of the divine field. This is exactly how it works.
I guess I was just about to ask you how we can accomplish this on a practical level with everything that's happening in the world that's so violent. But I guess you've given that, so you've answered that question.
Do I have a minute to give you an example?
Well, you do. I mean, I was just going to say, I no longer see good and evil. I see behaviors. But go ahead.
They're just different experiences. So, David, let's say that you and I have some kind of conflict. This is what happens in the field of energy from a looking at it in the actual energy patterns kind of way. If you and I have a energy of conflict between us, and what that looks like in an energy perspective, it looks like a knotted thread that you and I wind around each of us, and we just kind of get all tangled up in it. It doesn't matter where we are in the world. In our field of awareness, you and I have a thread of conflict between us. And as you're on your end of your world telling everybody how awful I was in this situation, you've got these little subsidiary threads of blame and victimhood and anger and all these other things. And you're just wrapping those around everybody that you're talking to. And I'm on my end doing exactly the same thing. And I'm wrapping it around all the people that I'm talking about you. And so now all of us are just bound in this massive entanglement of conflict energies just based on the core thread that you and I carry. From a planetary perspective, this is what we have looked like. We are planetarily bound down in these energies of conflict. We're entangled in these. But if I, in this instance, if I get to a place where I authentically dig deep and own everything that I honestly feel about this, my anger, my resentment, my regret, everything. And I get to finally a place of authentic forgiveness. And that is forgiveness only of me. It is not forgiveness of you, because that would be a judgment that you've done something wrong.
Right.
This is only forgiveness of me in the way that I've perceived or behaved or whatever. In that moment, the moment that I get to an authentic place of forgiveness, what happens to that thread around me is that it just opens up and begins to flow, because now I've transmuted that to love. And when that opens up on my end, what happens to your end, because you no longer have the push and pull on me, is that your end begins to open up and flow as well. And when that happens, it all begins to open up and flow with all of the people around you that you've been talking with. And the same thing is happening on me and my end. And now there is an energy of openness and flow around all of us, simply because I did my work of getting into that deep place of allowing the truth to be owned and felt and seen and transmuted. And this, on a planetary basis, is also what's happening with us now, that more and more of us are beginning to do this individual work to open ourselves up from these old paradigms. And this energy is now beginning to flow more freely in the collective. And this is why you see, on a collective basis around our world, many more conversations now about unconditional love. You see much greater swell of equality in the last 100 years around gender and race and sexual orientation. You see a much greater freedom of expression of people that's being led so beautifully right now by the transgendered community. You see a much greater conversation about oneness now and unification. And entire industries have been built on the acceptance of what is in this present moment, the power of now. And so these are
very
all
true.
The components of divine love that are rising up collectively, because what we're doing on an individual basis is recognizing our need to incorporate everything about ourselves.
Wow, that is just so beautifully
Amazing.
Put, Mary. So beautifully put. It's interesting, we actually have a friend who practices the healing codes.
Right, I was about to mention that.
And the healing codes are all about actually changing, transmuting the energies.
And not only that, her basic philosophy is that Ho'oponopono, and also that your first relationship, your first agreement is always with yourself. And everything starts from the inside out. And it doesn't,
sure.
nothing, no one else and nothing else matters. It's all about you and your relationship with
you
everything outside of you.
So. Amazing. Very, very
And
profound.
She would have been here today, but
yes,
unfortunately she's not. She would have loved to have heard what you've said on our show today, because it's truly amazing and consistent with what she says as well, Susan Glenn.
Well, Mary, I'm going to go and buy your book. I'm just absolutely blown away.
I am loving what you're saying.
It's
fantastic,
so,
and clear.
Yeah, it's about the alchemy of energy and the transmutation.
Yes, beautifully put. That's right.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much for being
Thank
on our show.
Thank you very much.
We really
it's a pleasure
that.
And an honor. Thank you so much. And I also want to say just a big thank you to you two for the work that you do on behalf of all of us and all that you allow to happen in our world. You play a very important role, and I'm very grateful for you and your work and your willingness.
Thank you very much.
And we'll say the same for Dawn and Doug Newsome at BBS Radio Network for all their work behind the scenes that they do for us and on all our guests that have been on the show and everyone listening. You're all wonderful, and we love you all, and we love you too, Mary. Lots of love.
And everyone,
love
have a
to
great
you
week.
Too. Thank you. All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. Okay.